Eliza found herself wondering that this blotchy old man could be related to her beautiful mother. The tip of his pale tongue appeared between his lips.
"I hear you have performed well in the schoolroom during the years you've been at Blackhurst."
"Yes, sir," said Eliza.
"And according to my man, Davies, you are fond of the gardens."
"Yes, uncle." From her first morning at Blackhurst, Eliza had been enamored of the estate. Along with the passageways that ran beneath the cliffs, she knew the cleared part of the maze and the wider garden as well as she'd once known the foggy streets of London. And no matter how far and wide she explored, the garden grew and changed with each season.
"It is within our family. Your mother..." His voice cracked. "Your mother, when she was a girl, had a great fondness for the garden."
Eliza tried to accord this information with her own memories of mother. Through the tunnel of time came fragmented images. Mother in the windowless room above Mrs. Swindle's shop. A small pot with a fragrant herb. It hadn't lasted long. There was little that could survive in such dim conditions.
"Come closer, child,"
the uncle said, beckoning with his hand.
"Come into the light, that I might see you."
Eliza went to the other side of the desk so that she was standing by his knees. The room's smell was stronger now, as if it were coming from her uncle himself. He reached out a hand, trembling slightly, and caressed the golden ends of Eliza's long red hair. Lightly, so lightly. Withdrew his hand, as if scorched. He shuddered.
"Are you unwell, uncle? Should I fetch someone to help?"
"No," he answered quickly. "No."
He reached out to stroke her hair once more, closed his eyes. Eliza was so near that she could see the eyeballs moving beneath his lids, could hear the tiny clicking noises in his throat.
"We searched so long, so wide to bring your mother, to bring our Georgiana home."
"Yes, sir." Mary had told Eliza as much. About Uncle Linus's attachment to his younger sister, his heartbreak when she left, his frequent trips to London, the searching that had consumed his youth and his little good humour, the eagerness with which he left Blackhurst each time, the inevitable disappointment of his return, the way he would sit alone in the dark room drinking sherry, refusing any counsel, even that of Aunt Adeline, until Mr. Mansell would appear once more with a new lead.
"We were too late."
He was stroking harder now, wrapping Eliza's long hair around his fingers, this way and that, like a ribbon. It was pulling, and Eliza had to hold the edge of the desk to save herself from stumbling. She was transfixed by his face. It was that of the wounded fairy tale king whose subjects have all deserted him.
"I was too late. But you are here now. By God's grace, I have been given another chance."
"Uncle?" Her uncle's hand dropped to his lap and his eyelids peeled open. He pointed to a little bench on the far wall, shrouded in white muslin cloth.
"Sit," he said.
Eliza blinked at him.
"Sit."
He limped to a black tripod by the wall.
"I wish to take your photograph."
Eliza had never had a photograph taken, had no interest in having one taken now. Just as she opened her mouth to tell him so, the door opened.
"The birthday luncheon?"
Aunt Adeline's words ended with a shrill rise. Her thin hand leapt to her chest.
"Eliza!"
The word was passenger on a desperate exhalation.
"Whatever are you thinking, girl? Upstairs at once. Rose is asking for you."
Eliza hurried towards the door.
"And stop bothering your uncle,"
hissed Aunt Adeline as Eliza passed her.
"Can't you see he's exhausted from his travels?"
And so the day had come. Adeline hadn't known what form it would take, but the threat had always been there, lurking in dark places, so she could never fully be at ease. She ground her teeth, channeled her rage into the bones at the back of her neck, willed herself to clear the image from her mind. Georgiana's girl, her hair hanging loose, looking for all the world like a ghost from the past, and the expression on Linus's face, his old face turned foolish by a young man's desire. To think he had been about to take the girl's photograph, to do what he had never done for Rose, nor for Adeline. "Close your eyes, Lady Maltrichet," said her maid, and Adeline did as she was asked. The other woman's breath was warm as she brushed the hair from Adeline's brow, strangely comforting. Oh, to sit here forever, the warm, sweet breath of this dull, cheerful girl on her face, no other thoughts to plague her. "And open again, ma'am, while I fetch your pearls." The maid bustled away, and Adeline was left alone with her thoughts. She leaned forward. Her brows were smooth, her hair neat. She pinched each cheek, harder perhaps than was necessary, and sat back again to observe the whole. Oh, but to age was cruel. Little changes that slipped by unnoticed, that could never be arrested. The nectar of youth slipping through a blind sieve whose holes continued to widen. "And thus was friend turned to foe," whispered Adeline to the merciless mirror. "Here you are, ma'am," said the maid. "I've brought the set with the ruby clasp. Nice and festive on such a happy occasion. Who could have imagined it? Miss Rose's birthday luncheon. 18 years old. A wedding next, you mark my words." As the maid babbled on, Adeline shifted her gaze, refusing to look any longer upon her own decay. The photograph hung where it always had, beside the dressing table. How proper she looked in her bridal dress. How right. No one would guess by this photo at the fierce self-coaxing she'd suffered in order to effect this model of calm. Linus, for his part, looked every bit the gentleman groom. Glum, perhaps, but that was the custom. They were married a year after Georgiana disappeared. From the moment of their engagement, Adeline Langley had worked hard to reinvent herself. She determined to become a woman worthy of the grand old name of Maltrichet. Cast off her northern accent and small-town tastes, devoured the writings of Debrett's, and schooled herself in the twin arts of vanity and gentility. Adeline knew she had to be twice as much a lady as anyone else if she were to wipe from people's memories the reality of her origins. "Would you like your green bonnet, Lady Maltrichet?" said the maid. "Only it always suits this dress so well, and you'll be wanting a hat if you're headed to the cove. I'll lay it out on the bed, shall I?" Their wedding night had been nothing like Adeline expected. She couldn't tell, and certainly there were no words to ask, but she suspected it had disappointed Linus, too. They shared a marriage bed only rarely afterwards, even less when Linus started his roaming. "Taking photographs," he said, but Adeline knew the truth. How worthless she felt, how failed as a wife and as a woman. Worse still, failed as a society lady. For all her efforts, they were rarely invited out. Linus, when he was at Blackhurst, was such poor company, standing alone most of the time, answering questions when necessary, with belligerent remarks. When Adeline grew sickly, pale, and tired, she presumed it was despair. Only when her stomach began to swell did she realize she was with child. "There you are, Lady Maltrichet. Your hat's on the bed, and you're all ready for the party." "Thank you, Poppy." She managed a thin smile. "That will be all." As the door closed, Adeline dismantled her smile and met her own gaze once more. Rose was the rightful inheritor of the Maltrichet glory. This girl, Georgiana's daughter, was little more than a cuckoo sent back to supplant Adeline's own child, to push her from a nest that Adeline had fought to make her own. For a time, order had been maintained. Adeline made sure to decorate Rose with darling new dresses, a pretty sofa to sit upon, while Eliza was clothed in the previous season's fashions. Rose's manners, her feminine nature, were perfect, where Eliza could not be taught. Adeline was calm. But as the girls grew older, grew unstoppably towards womanhood, things were changing, slipping from Adeline's control. Eliza's prowess in the schoolroom was one thing. No one liked a clever woman. But now, with the time she spent outdoors in the fresh sea air, her complexion had taken on a healthy glow. Her hair, that accursed red hair, had grown long, and she was filling out. The other day, Adeline had heard one of the servants talking about how beautiful Miss Eliza was, more beautiful even than her mother, Miss Georgiana. Adeline had frozen in her tracks when she'd heard the name spoken. After all these years of silence, it now awaited her at every corner, laughing at her, reminding her of her own inferiority, her own failure ever to match up, despite working so much harder than Georgiana. Adeline felt a dull thump in her temple. She raised her hand and pressed lightly. Something was the matter with Rose. This spot on her temple was Adeline's sixth sense. Ever since Rose was a tiny baby, Adeline had preempted her daughter's maladies. It was a bond that couldn't be broken, mother to daughter. And now her temple was once again throbbing. Adeline's lips tightened with resolve. She observed her stern face as if it belonged to a stranger. The lady of a noble house, a woman whose control was infrangible. She inhaled strength into that woman's lungs. Rose must be protected. Poor Rose, who failed even to perceive Eliza as a threat. An idea began to form in Adeline's mind. She couldn't send Eliza away. Linus would never permit it, and Rose's sorrow would be too great, and besides, it was better to keep one's enemies close. But perhaps Adeline might find a reason to take Rose abroad for a time. To Paris. Or New York. Give her an opportunity to shine without the unexpected glare of Eliza drawing everyone's attention, ruining Rose's every chance. Adeline smoothed her skirt as she went towards the door. One thing was certain. There would be no visiting the cove today. It was a foolish promise to have made, a moment of weakness on Adeline's part. Thank God there was still time to correct her error in judgment. Eliza's wickedness would not be allowed to taint Rose. She closed the door behind her and started down the hall, skirt swishing. As for Linus, he would be kept busy. She was his wife. It was her duty to ensure he was given no opportunity to suffer at the hands of his own impulses. He would be packed off to London. She would implore the wives of government ministers to enlist his services, suggest exotic photographic locations, send him far away. Satan would not be allowed to find mischief for his idle hands to do. Linus leaned back against the garden seat and hooked his cane beneath the decorative arm. The sun was setting and dusk spilled, orange and pink, across the western edge of the estate. There had been plenty of rain throughout the month, and the garden glistened. Not that Linus cared. For centuries, the Montrachets had been keen horticulturalists. Forebear after forebear had travelled far and wide, spanning the globe in search of exotic specimens with which to augment their plot. Linus, however, had not inherited the green thumb. That had gone to his little sister. Well, now, that wasn't completely true. There had been a time long ago when he had cared for the garden. When, as a boy, he had followed Davies on his rounds, marveling at the spiky flowers in the Antipodean garden, the pineapples in the hothouse, the way new shoots appeared overnight, taking the place of seeds he'd helped to lay. Most miraculous of all, in the garden Linus's shame had disappeared. The plants, the trees, the flowers cared not at all that his left leg had stopped growing inches short of his right. That his left foot was a useless appendage, stunted and curved, freakish. There was a place for everything and everyone in the Blackhurst garden. Then, when Linus was 7, he'd become lost in the maze. Davies had warned him not to go inside alone, that the way was long and dark, full of obstacles, but Linus had been dizzy on the thrill of being 7 years old. The maze, with its dense, lush walls, its promise of adventure, had lured him. He was a knight, off to do battle with the fiercest dragon in the land, and he was going to emerge triumphant, to find his way to the other side. Shadows came early to the maze. Linus had not foreseen how dark it would become and how quickly. In the dusk, sculptures came to life, leering at him from their hiding places. Tall hedges turned to hungry monsters. Low hedges played nasty tricks, made him think he was heading in the right direction, when in fact he was doubling back. Or was he? He had reached as far as the center before his slide to despair was complete. Then, to add injury to insult, a brass ring attached to a platform on the ground had leapt up and tripped him, tossed him to the ground so that his good ankle was twisted like that of a cheap rag doll. There'd been little choice for Linus but to sit where he was, ankle aching, angry tears spilling hot down his cheeks. Linus had waited and waited. Dusk became dark, cool became cold, and his tears dried up. He later learned that it was Father who had refused to send anyone in for him. He was a boy, Father said, and, lame or not, any boy worth his salt would find his own way out of the maze. Why, he, St. John Luke, had made it through when a mere 4 years old. The boy needed to toughen up. Linus had shivered in the maze all night before Mother finally convinced Father to send Davies in after him. It took a week before Linus's ankle healed, but every day for a fortnight thereafter, Father marched Linus back to the maze, set him to finding his way through, then berated him for his inevitable failure. Linus began to dream of the maze, and when he was awake, drew maps from memory. He worked at it like a mathematical problem, for he knew there must be a solution. If he were worth his salt, he'd find it. After 2 weeks, Father gave up. On the 15th morning, when Linus appeared for his daily test, he didn't even lower his newspaper. "You're a great disappointment," he said. "A fool of a boy who will never amount to anything." He turned a page, shook the paper straight, and scanned for headlines of note. "Remove yourself from my room." Linus had never gone near the maze again. Unable to bring himself to blame Father and Mother for his shameful failings. They were right, after all. What kind of a boy couldn't find his way through a maze? He blamed the garden. He took to breaking the stems of plants, removing flowers, stepping on new shoots. All are shaped by things beyond their control, traits inherited, traits learned. For Linus, the piece of his leg bone that had refused to lengthen defined him. As he grew, lameness begot shyness, shyness begot a stammer, and thus Linus grew into an unlikable little boy who discovered that attention came his way only when he behaved badly. He refused to go outside, so his skin grew pallid and his good leg thin. He put insects in his mother's tea, thorns in his father's slippers, and gladly took whatever punishment came his way. And thus, in such predictable form, Linus's life continued. Then, when he was 10 years old, a baby sister was born. Linus despised her on sight. so soft and fair and bonny. And as Linus discovered when he peered beneath her long lacy frock, perfectly formed. Both legs the same length. Dear little feet, not a useless, wizened piece of flesh among them. Worse than her physical perfection, though, was her happiness. Her pink smile, her musical laugh. What business did she have being so happy when he, Linus, was miserable? Linus determined to do something about it. Whenever he could get away from his governess, he would sneak into the nursery and kneel by the edge of the bassinet. If the baby slept, he would make a sudden noise to startle her. If she reached for a toy, he would move it away. If she held out her arms, he would cross his own. If she smiled, he would arrange his features into a mask of appalling horror. Yet she remained unaffected. Nothing Linus did could make her cry. Nothing dinted her sunny disposition. It perplexed him, and he set his mind to inventing sly and singular punishments for his little sister. As Linus grew into his teens, became even more awkward, with long gangly arms and odd ginger hairs sprouting from his spotty chin, Georgiana blossomed into a beautiful child, beloved of all on the estate. She brought a smile to the face of even the most hardened tenants. Farmers who hadn't had a kind word for the Mountrachet family in years would send baskets of apples to the kitchen for Miss Georgiana to enjoy. Then one day, Linus was sitting on the window ledge in the library, using his treasured new magnifying glass to turn ants to ash, when he slipped and fell. He was unharmed, but his precious glass shattered into 100 tiny pieces. So cherished was his new toy, so used to disappointing himself was he, that despite his 13 years, Linus burst into tears of rage, great, hulking sobs. He reproached himself for having fallen in such a clumsy way, for not being clever enough, for having no friends, for being unlovable, for being born imperfect. His tears were so blinding that Linus didn't realize his fall had been observed. Not until he felt the tap against his arm. He looked up and saw his little sister standing there, holding something towards him. It was Claudine, her favorite dolly.
"Linus sad," she said. "Poor Linus. Claudine make Linus happy."
Linus had been speechless, had taken the doll, still staring at his little sister as she sat beside him. With an uncertain sneer, he pushed one of Claudine's eyelids so that it was dented. Looked to see what effect his vandalism had had on his little sister. She was sucking her thumb, watching him, big blue eyes full of empathy. After a moment, she reached out and dented Claudine's other lid. From that day forth, they were a team. Without complaint, without so much as a frown, she weathered her brother's rages, his cruel humor, all the things that rejection had wrought in him. She let him fight her and berate her, and later, cuddle her. If only they'd been left alone, everything would have turned out well. But mother and father couldn't bear that someone loved him. He heard them speaking in low voices, too much time together, not proper, not healthy, and within a matter of months he was packed off to boarding school. His grades were appalling, Linus made sure of that, but father had once hunted with the master of Balliol College, and thus a place was found for him at Oxford. The only positive thing to come out of his university days was his discovery of photography. A sensitive young English tutor had allowed him use of his camera, then advised him on his own purchase. And finally, when he was 23, Linus returned to Blackhurst. How his pupille had grown! 13 and so tall! The longest red hair he had ever seen. For a time, he was shy of her. She was so changed, he had to learn her again. But one day when he was photographing near the cove, she had appeared in his viewfinder, sitting on top of the black rock, facing out to sea. The salty breeze was weaving through her hair. Her arms were wrapped around her knees, and her legs were bare. Linus could hardly breathe. He blinked, continued to watch as she turned her head slowly, looked directly at him. Where other subjects couldn't conceal the knowingness in their eyes, Georgiana was completely unself-conscious. She seemed to be looking beyond the camera, directly into his eyes. Hers were the same empathetic eyes that had watched him crying all those years before. Without thinking, he squeezed the camera button. Her face, her perfect face, was his to capture. Carefully, Linus pulled the photographic print from his coat pocket. He was gentle, for it was old now, rough around the edges. The last of the sun's light was almost gone, but if he held it at the right angle... How many times had he sat like this and gazed upon it, pored over it after she disappeared? It was the only print he had, for when Georgiana left, someone, Mother, Adeline, one of their minions, had sneaked into his darkroom and removed his negatives. Only this one remained, spared because Linus carried it always on his person. But now a second chance, and this one Linus wouldn't lose. He was no longer a child, but master of Blackhurst. Mother and father were both in their graves. Only that tiresome wife of his and her sickly daughter remained, and who were they to stand in Linus's way? He had courted Adeline to punish his parents for Georgiana's flight, and the engagement had delivered such a final, brutal blow that the woman's accommodation in his house had seemed a small price to pay. And so it had been. So would it continue to be. She was easily ignored. He was master, and what he wanted, he would have. Eliza. He allowed the sound of it to escape across his lips, lodge within the curls of his beard. His lips were trembling, and his skin had cooled. He was going to make a gift to her, something to inspire gratitude, something he knew she'd love, for how could she not, when her mother had loved it so before her? Chapter 32, Cliff Cottage, 2005. Cassandra stepped through the gate and was struck once more by the strange, heavy silence that lay general around the cottage. There was something else, too, something she felt but couldn't name, an odd sense of collusion, as if by entering the gates she was agreeing to a pact whose rules she did not know. It was earlier in the day than the last time she'd come, and flecks of sunlight flickered in the garden. The landscaper wasn't due for another 15 minutes, so Cassandra put the key back in her pocket and decided to explore a little. A narrow stone path, almost obscured by lichen, wound along the front before disappearing around the corner. The weeds at the side of the house were tall and thick, and she had to pull them away from the wall before stepping through. There was something about the garden that reminded her of Nell's backyard in Brisbane. Not the plants so much as the mood. As long as Cassandra could remember, Nell's yard had been a jumble of cottage plants, herbs, and brightly coloured annuals. Little concrete paths winding their way through the growth. So different from the other suburban backyards, with their stretches of sunburned grass and the occasional thirsty rose bushes inside white-painted car tires. Cassandra reached the back of the cottage and stopped. A dense tangle of thorny brambles, at least 3 meters high, had grown across the path. She stepped closer and craned to see over the top. The shape was uniform, linear, almost as if the plants themselves had formed a wall. She made her way along the hedge, trailing her fingers lightly over jagged ivy leaves. It was slow going. The undergrowth was as high as her knees and threatened to trip her at each step. Midway along, she noticed a gap in the brambles. A small gap, but enough to see that no light shone through, that there was something solid behind it. Careful not to be pricked by the thorns, Cassandra reached her hand in and leaned closer as the hedge devoured her arm all the way to her shoulder. Her fingers scraped against something hard and cold. A wall. A stone wall, coated with moss, if the damp green smears on her fingertips were anything to go by. Cassandra wiped her hand on her jeans and pulled the title deeds from her back pocket, turned to the property map. The cottage was clearly marked, a small square towards the front of the block. According to the map, though, the rear property line extended quite a way beyond. Cassandra refolded the map and tucked it away. If the map was correct, this wall was part of Nell's property, not its boundary. It belonged to Cliff Cottage, as did whatever was on the other side. Cassandra continued her obstacle course along the wall, hoping to find a gate or a door, anything permitting entry. The sun was rising in the sky, and the birds had relaxed their singing. The air was heavy with the sweet, swooning perfume of a climbing rose. Although it was autumn, Cassandra was becoming hot. To think she had once imagined England a cold country to which the sun was a stranger. She stopped to wipe sweat from her brow and bumped her head on something low hanging. The gnarled bough of a tree reached arm-like over the wall. An apple tree, Cassandra realized when she saw that the branch bore fruit. Shiny, golden apples. They were so ripe, so deliciously fragrant, that she couldn't resist picking one. Cassandra checked her watch, and with a longing glance at the bramble hedge, started back the way she'd come. She could continue her search for a door later, didn't want to risk missing the gardener. Such was the odd sense of dense seclusion surrounding the cottage, Cassandra had the feeling she might not hear him from back here, even if he called out. She unlocked the front door and went inside. The house seemed to be listening, waiting to see what she would do. She ran her hand lightly along the inside wall. "My house," she said softly. "This is my house." The words pressed dully into the walls. How strange it was, how unexpected. She wandered through the kitchen, past the spinning wheel and into the little sitting room at the very front. The house felt different now that she was alone. Familiar somehow, like a place she'd visited long ago. She eased herself into an old rocker. Cassandra was comfortable enough with antique furniture to know that the chair wasn't about to collapse, and yet she felt wary, as if the chair's rightful owner was somewhere nearby and might return at any time to find an intruder in their place. As she polished the apple on her shirt, Cassandra turned her head to look through the dusty window. Creepers had plaited themselves together across the glass, but she could still see enough to make out the rambling garden beyond. There was a little statue she hadn't noticed before. A child, a boy, perched on a stone, staring at the house with wide-open eyes. Cassandra lifted the apple to her lips. The sunny scent was strong as she bit into it. An apple, from a tree in her very own garden, a tree planted many years before that still produced fruit, year in, year out. It was sweet. Were apples always so sweet? She yawned. The sun had made her very drowsy. She would sit, just for a little while longer, until the gardener arrived. She took another bite of the apple. The room felt warmer than it had before, as if the range had suddenly begun to work, as if someone else had joined her in the cottage and was beginning to make lunch. Her lids were heavy, and she closed her eyes. A bird somewhere sang, a lovely, lonely tune. Breeze-blown leaves tapped against the window, and in the distance the ocean breathed steadily. In and out. In and out. In and out. In and out of her head all day, She paced again across the kitchen, stopped at the window, but forbade herself another glance outside. She looked at her little mantel clock instead. He was late. He had said 1:30 the hour. She wondered whether his tardiness meant anything of consequence, whether he'd been caught up, fallen victim to second thoughts, whether he was still coming. Her cheeks were warm. It was very warm in here. She went back to the range and turned the damper to slow the burning, wondered whether she should have prepared some sort of meal. A noise outside. The flaws of her composure dissolved. He was here. She opened the door, and wordlessly he came inside. He seemed so large in the narrow hall, and though she knew him well by now, she was shy, couldn't meet his eyes. He was nervous too. She could see that, though he did his best to conceal it. They sat opposite one another at the kitchen table, and the lamplight quivered between them. A strange place to sit on such a night, but that was as it was. She looked at her hands, wondered how to proceed. It had all seemed so simple at first, but now the way forward seemed crisscrossed by threads just waiting to trip them up. Perhaps such meetings were always thus. He reached out. She drew breath as he caught a long thread of her hair between two fingers, looked at it for what seemed an age, looked not at the hair so much as the strange fact of her hair in his fingers. Finally, his gaze lifted and met her own. His hand came to rest lightly on her cheek. He smiled then, and so did she, sighed with relief and something else. He opened his mouth and said, "Hello," a loud rapping sound. "Hello, anyone there?" Cassandra's eyes flicked open. The apple in her hand dropped to the floor. Heavy footsteps, and then a man was standing in the doorway. A tall, solidly built man in his mid-40s. Dark hair, dark eyes, wide smile. "Hello there," he said, holding his hands in an attitude of surrender. "You look as if you've seen a ghost." "You frightened me," said Cassandra defensively, pulling herself out of the chair. "Sorry." He stepped forward. "The door was open. Didn't realize you were having a kip." "I wasn't. I mean, I was. But I didn't mean to. I only meant to sit for a while, but..." Cassandra's explanation trailed off as her mind returned to the dream. It had been a long time since she'd dreamed anything even remotely erotic. A long time since she'd done anything remotely erotic. Not since Nick. Well, not so that it counted. Not so that she wanted to remember. Where on earth had it come from? The man grinned and extended his hand. "I'm Michael Blake, landscaper extraordinaire. You must be Cassandra." "That's right." She blushed as he closed his large, warm hand around hers. He shook his head slightly, smiling. "My mate told me Australian girls were the prettiest, but I never believed him. Now I know he was telling the truth." Cassandra didn't know where to look, settled for a spot just beyond his left shoulder. Such open flirtation made her uncomfortable at the best of times, but her dream had left her doubly unsettled. She could still sense it, lingering in the room's corners. "I hear you've got a problem with a tree."
"Yes." Cassandra blinked and nodded as she pushed the dream aside. "Yes, I have. Thanks for coming."
"Never could resist a damsel in distress."
He smiled again, a broad, easy smile. She pulled her cardigan a little tighter round her middle, tried to smile back, but managed only to feel prim. "It's over this way, on the stairs." Michael followed her along the hall, leaned to see around the curve of the stairwell. He whistled.
"One of the old pines. Looks like she's been lying here a while. Probably came down in the big storm of 95.
Can you move it?
Course we can.
Michael looked over his shoulder, past Cassandra.
Get the chainsaw, will you, Chris?
Cassandra turned. She hadn't been aware there was anyone else in the room with them. Another man stood behind her, leaner than the first, a little younger. Sandy brown hair curled roughly around his neck. Olive skin, brown eyes.
Christian, he said, nodding slightly. He extended his hand a little, hesitated, then wiped it on his jeans, held it out again. Cassandra reached to meet it.
Chainsaw, Chris, said Michael. Come on, speed it up.
Michael raised his eyebrows at Cassandra as Christian left.
I'm due at the hotel in a half hour or so, but never fear. I'll get the main work done and leave my trusty sidekick to finish up.
He smiled at Cassandra with the sort of direct gaze she found impossible to hold.
So this is your place. I've lived in the village my whole life and never thought it was owned by anyone.
I'm still getting used to the idea myself. Michael cocked an eyebrow as he took in the dereliction of the room.
What's a nice Aussie girl like you doing in a house like this?
I inherited it. My grandmother left it to me.
Your grandmother was English?
Australian. She bought it in the 70s when she was on holiday.
Some souvenir. Couldn't she find a tea towel she liked?
A noise at the door, and Christian was back, carrying a large chainsaw.
This the one you're after? It's a saw with a chain, said Michael, winking at Cassandra. I'd say it's the right one.
The hall was narrow, and Cassandra turned side on to let Christian pass. She didn't meet his eyes, rather pretended interest in a loose skirting board at her feet. The way Michael spoke to Christian made her feel embarrassed.
Chris is new to the business, said Michael, oblivious to Cassandra's discomfort. Doesn't know his chainsaw from his drop saw yet. He's a bit of a greenie, but we'll turn him into a woodcutter yet.
He grinned.
He's a Blake. It's in his blood.
He gave his brother a playful punch, and the two men turned their attention to the task at hand. Cassandra was relieved when the chainsaw started up and she was free, finally, to escape back to the garden. Although she knew her time would be better spent clearing creepers from inside the house, her interest had been piqued. She was determined to find a way through that wall, if it took all day. The sun was high now, and shade was at a premium. Cassandra unwrapped her cardigan and laid it on a nearby rock. The sun's tiny footprints danced across her arms, and the top of her head was soon hot to the touch. She wished she'd remembered to bring a hat. As she searched the brambles, poked her hand gingerly through one gap after another, avoiding thorns, her thoughts drifted back to her dream. It had been particularly vivid, and she could remember every detail, sights, smells, even the dream's pervasive mood. Undeniably erotic, laced with forbidden desire. Cassandra shook her head a little, shooing away the tendrils of confusing and unwanted emotion. She turned her thoughts instead to Nell's mystery. The night before, she'd sat up late reading the notebook, a task that was easier said than done. If the rash of mold didn't make things difficult enough, Nell's deplorable handwriting had deteriorated further when she arrived in Cornwall. Longer, loopier, scratchier. Written faster, Cassandra was willing to bet. More excitedly. Nonetheless, Cassandra was managing. She'd been spellbound by the account of Nell's returning memories, her certainty that she'd visited the cottage as a little girl. Cassandra couldn't wait to see the scrapbooks Julia had found, the diaries that Nell's mother had once filled with her most private thoughts. For surely they would shed further light on Nell's childhood.
maybe even offer vital clues as to her disappearance with Eliza Makepeace. A whistle, loud and shrill. Cassandra looked up, expecting a bird of some kind. Michael was standing by the corner of the house, watching her work. He indicated the brambles.
Impressive crop you've got there.
Nothing a bit of weeding won't solve, she said, standing awkwardly. She wondered how long he'd been watching.
A year of weeding, and a chainsaw.
He grinned.
I'm off, up to the hotel now.
He cocked his head towards the cottage.
We've made some good headway. I'll leave Chris to tie up loose ends. He should be able to manage. Just make sure he leaves it how you'd like.
He paused and smiled again in that artless way of his.
You've got my number, right? Give me a call. I'll show you a few of the local sights while you're in town.
It wasn't a question. Cassandra smiled slightly and regretted it immediately. She suspected Michael was the sort to read any response as agreement. Sure enough, he gave her a wink as he headed back towards the front of the house. With a sigh, Cassandra turned back towards the wall. Christian had climbed through the hole made by the tree and was now perched on the roof, using a handsaw to cut the branches into lengths. Where Michael was easygoing, there was an intensity about Christian that seemed to spill into everything he did and touched. He shifted position, and Cassandra looked away quickly, feigned an avid interest in her wall. They continued working, and the silence strung between them amplified every other sound. Christian's saw dragging back and forth, the pitter-patter of birds on the roof tiles, the faint noise of running water somewhere. Ordinarily, Cassandra was happy to work without speaking. She was used to being alone, preferred it for the most part. Only this wasn't being alone, and the longer they pretended it was, the more static-filled the silence grew. Finally, she could stand it no longer. "There's a wall behind here," she said, voice loud and somewhat more strident than she'd intended. "I found it earlier." Christian looked up from his stack of wood, stared at her as if she'd just started quoting from the periodic table. "I don't know what's on the other side, though," she rushed on. "I can't find a gate, and the plan my grandmother got with the sale gives no indication. I know there's a heap of creepers and branches, but I thought you might be able to see from up there." Christian glanced down at his hands, seemed about to speak. A thought popped into Cassandra's mind. He has nice hands. She pushed it right back where it came from. "Can you see what's over the wall?" He pressed his lips together, dusted his hands on his jeans, and nodded a little. "You can?" This she hadn't really expected. "What is it? Can you tell me?"
"I can do better than that," he said, holding onto the eave so that he could jump down from the roof. "Come on, I'll show you."
The hole was very small, right at the bottom of the wall, and concealed so that Cassandra might have searched for a year and not found it. Christian was on his hands and knees, pulling the undergrowth aside. "Ladies first," he said, sitting back. Cassandra looked at him. "I thought maybe there'd be a gate." "You find one, I'll follow you through it." "You want me to..." She glanced at the hole. "I don't know if I can, if I even know how to." "On your stomach. It's not as tight as it looks." Of this Cassandra had some doubt. It looked very tight. All the same, the day's fruitless searching had only strengthened her resolve. She needed to know what lay on the other side. She hopped down so she was eye level with the hole and looked sidelong at Christian. "Are you sure this is safe? You've done it before?" at least 100 times. He scratched his neck. Sure, I was younger and smaller, but... His lips twitched sideways. I'm joking. I'm sorry. You'll be fine. There was some relief once her head was free, and she realized she wasn't going to perish with her neck jammed beneath a brick wall. Not on the way in, at any rate. She shimmied the rest of her body through, as fast as possible, and stood up, dusted her hands together, and looked around, wide-eyed. It was a garden. A walled garden. Overgrown, but with beautiful bones visible still. Someone had cared for this garden once. The remains of two paths snaked back and forth, intertwined like the lacing on an Irish dancing shoe. Fruit trees had been espaliered around the sides, and wires zigzagged from the top of one wall to the top of another. Hungry wisteria tendrils had woven themselves around to form a sort of canopy. Against the southern wall, an ancient and knobbled tree was growing. Cassandra went closer. It was the apple tree, she realized, the one whose bough had reached over the wall. She lifted her hand to touch one of the golden fruit. The tree was about 5 meters high and shaped like the Japanese bonsai plant Nell had given Cassandra for her 12th birthday. Over the decades, the short trunk had adopted a sideways angle, and someone had gone to the effort of propping a crutch beneath a large limb to absorb some of its weight. A scorch mark midway along suggested a lightning strike many years before. Cassandra reached out to run her fingers along the burn. It's magical, isn't it, this place? Christian was standing in the center of the garden by a rusted iron bench. Even when I was a kid, I could feel that. You used to come here. All the time. It felt like my secret spot. No one else knew about it. He shrugged. Well, hardly anyone else. Beyond Christian, on the other side of the garden, Cassandra noticed something glinting against the creeper-covered wall. She went closer. It was metal, shining in the sun. A door. Rope-like tendrils draped across it, a giant web blocking the entrance to the spider's lair. Or exit, as the case may be. Christian joined her, and together they pulled some of the brambles loose. There was a brass handle turned black with time. Cassandra gave it a rattle. The door was locked. I wonder where it goes. There is a maze on the other side that leads all the way through the estate, said Christian. It ends over near the hotel. Michael's been working to restore it these past months. The maze. Of course, she had known that. Where had Cassandra read about the maze? Was it Nell's notebook? One of the tourist brochures at the hotel? A quivering dragonfly hovered near before darting away, and they turned back towards the center of the garden. Why did your grandmother buy the cottage? Said Christian, brushing a fallen leaf from his shoulder. She was born around here. In the village? Cassandra hesitated, wondering how much she should tell. The estate, actually. Blackhurst. She didn't know until her adoptive father died, when she was in her 60s. She found out her parents were Rose and Nathaniel Walker. He was an artist. I know. Christian picked up a small stick from the ground. I've got a book with his illustrations in it. A book of fairy tales. Magical tales for girls and boys. Yeah. He looked at her, surprised. I have a copy, too. He raised his eyebrows. There weren't many printed, you know. Not by today's standards. Did you know Eliza Makepeace used to live right here in the cottage? Cassandra shook her head. I knew she grew up on the estate. Most of her stories were written here, in this garden. You know a lot about her. I've been rereading the fairy tales lately. I used to love them when I was a kid. Ever since I found an old copy in the local charity shop. There was something bewitching about them, more than met the eye. He scuffed at the dirt with his boot. It's a bit sad, I guess. A grown man reading children's fairy tales. I don't think so. Cassandra noticed that he was raising and lowering his shoulders, hands in pockets, almost as if he were nervous. Which one's your favorite? He tilted his head, squinted a little in the sun. The crone's eyes. Really? Why? It always seemed different from the others. More meaningful, somehow. Plus, I had a wild 8-year-old crush on the princess. He smiled shyly. What's not to like about a girl whose castle is destroyed, her royal subjects vanquished, who nonetheless plucks up enough courage to embark on a quest and uncover the old crone's missing eyes? Cassandra smiled, too. The tale of the brave princess who didn't know she was a princess was the first of Eliza's fairy tales she'd read. On that hot Brisbane day, when she was 10 years old and had disobeyed her grandmother's instruction, discovered the suitcase under the bed. Christian broke his stick in half and tossed the pieces aside. I suppose you're going to try and sell the cottage? Why? Interested in buying it? On the wage Mike's paying me? Briefly, their eyes met. Don't hold your breath. I don't know how I'm going to get it ready, she said. I didn't realize how much work there'd be. The garden, the house itself. She gestured over the southern wall. There's a hole in the bloody roof. How long are you here for? I'm booked at the hotel for another 3 weeks. He nodded. That ought to be enough time. You reckon? Sure. Such faith. And you haven't even seen me wield a hammer. He reached up to plait a stray piece of wisteria in with the others. I'll help you. Cassandra felt a flush of embarrassment. He thought she'd been hinting. I didn't mean... I don't have... She exhaled. There's no restoration budget, none at all. He smiled, the first proper smile she'd seen him give. I'm earning peanuts already. Might as well earn nothing working in a place I love. Chapter 33, Tregenna, 1975. Nell looked out over the churning sea. It was the first overcast day she'd struck since arriving in Cornwall, and the whole landscape was shivering. The white cottages clinging to cold crags, the silvery gulls, the grey sky reflecting the swollen sea. Best view in all of Cornwall, said the estate agent. Nell didn't dignify the inanity with comment. She continued to watch the roiling waves from the little dormer